So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm David Hampton, and I'm your host today. And Nate Larkin is out again on assignment, and we are going to eventually, these assignments are going to slow down, and Nate will be joining us again very, very soon. But today, you are in for a real treat, because we have a really special guest who has some really unique perspectives on how feelings and our nature as human beings and just the way we are wired plays into our recovery and our addictions and our just our basic behaviors and the things that give us fits. And you know, I spent the weekend at Rex, and I are here today at Crossroads of the Nation, and I spent the weekend with my grandson Rex this weekend, and he is 9 months old, and I don't know if you can call it babysitting if you're a grandparent. I think it's just spending time with the most precious little guy on the whole planet Earth, and so I don't really call it babysitting, but he is so much fun, because, you know, here's the thing. At 9 months old, human nature is coming out all over him. You have nothing but pure, just unadulterated feelings, and he can smile and laugh, and 90% of the time that's his MO. He is laughing, smiling. He can crawl like a race car across the floor, and but if he's not happy, boy, there's no secret. You know, so he hasn't learned the I'm fine filter yet. So I'm going to entrust that to my daughter and son-in-law, that, you know, they need to get around to that just enough to just to make him a little more easy, because he is an open book of emotion, and I love him to death. And it has been a joy to just watch him come into this world and change it for all of us. But to say all that is to say, part of what we're going to talk about today is just what makes us human and how that impacts us spiritually and in recovery, and why it in some circles is a scary thing to be honest with our vulnerable selves. So, folks, stay where you are, and we will be right back with Phil Herndon, who is the executive director of the Professionals Program at Journey Pure Treatment Center here in the greater Nashville area. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and our guest today is Phil Herndon. And Phil, you are the executive director of the Professionals Program at Journey Pure, which is a treatment center just outside of Nashville, mm-hmm. Here in the greater Nashville area where we all live. And we've had various colleagues of yours here in the past episodes. Chip Dodd was gracious enough to come on and join us one week, and we've had Cynthia Henderson, who was mm-hmm. a guest of his, who's one of your directors and reps, I believe, and yep. And we've just I know Dr. Brian Wind at your facility, uh-huh. and we've been really privileged to kind of just see and hear about what you all are doing. But you're involved there in a number of ways, but you're also involved in some other ministry areas that impact recovery that I'd also like to talk about eventually here. But tell us a little bit about what you do out there on the Big Horse Farm.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It
120,
is.
I believe, 127 acres.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Rutherford County territory. Well, we, Chip and I, who you mentioned, were it was called Center for Professional Excellence, CPE for short, and we were a freestanding treatment center for professional men, and I remember Chip's definition of that. It's stuck with me through all these years. A professional is a person who can bring their hands, their head, and their heart to their work.
Wow.
You know, it's not vocationally centered,
right?
But it's relationally and emotionally centered. So it doesn't matter if you read meters or you do brain surgery or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If you can do the skill, if you can engage your mind in what your work is and bring heart and passion and vision and appetite and desire and
right.
hopes and wants and dreams and all that to what you do, then that means you're a professional.
Yeah.
You bring your heart to it too. So that's who we've treated.
Yeah.
For many years. Chip opened it in 1996, and I joined in 2005, so we've been together for a long time. We actually met in graduate school. I was a graduate student in 1990 at a psych hospital. We were staff at psych hospital in 1990 and kept in contact, and so started doing it together in 2005. And so that's who we treat, and so we moved over to the Journey Pure campus and became part of their work almost exactly 2 years ago, July 24th. Of 2017.
Wow. And that's a thriving program now, from what I understand. And you guys are doing some great things with people coming in. And is it still as long a program as it used to be when back in the days when you all were separate from Journey Pure?
It isn't. We've changed some things. I think it's some great changes, actually. I guess you would call it a hybrid. We were very heavy with medical personnel, lots of physicians and dentists and pharmacists. But obviously, we still love treating those folks. But we've opened it up since getting to Journey Pure, actually just the last several months. We've opened up into it's called a professionals program or an executives program, where we're doing people from the business world, the ministry world more, and the stays, the optional stays are different, 30 days, 45 days, 60 days, 90 days, and it's kind of become a more flexible length of stay program.
Yeah. Do you have trouble getting insurance to agree to those longer stays?
We do.
Yeah. I know that's like a...
Great question, David.
Really?
That's a hard one.
Slow, underhanded pitch there.
Yeah,
for you,
man. Thanks for the sludge on a T. Why, yes, David, we do.
Yeah.
Funny you should ask.
Funny. Someone would think to ask that for me.
Good grief. Yeah. It's a pretty, standard managed care model.
Yeah.
And there are certainly some restrictions. And, so far we found, we were 84 days for years, 12 weeks, 84 days. And we found only self-pay, but we found through time, we trust the process, as they say. We trust God with that. And if a guy can stay 30 days, we're just going to, as we say, we're going to treat the fire out of him for 30 days and give him everything we can give him. And we tell guys all the time, this isn't a prediction, but if you don't make it, if you relapse or this wasn't enough, man, you come back.
Yeah.
And we'll keep going.
Yeah. That's great. And yourself personally, if we go back further than CPE for you. Do you have a recovery story of your own?
I do. Yes, I do. I started kind of a, I guess you would say, typical Southern upbringing. Grew up near Atlanta. I grew up in Marietta before everybody in the world moved there. It was a smaller town when I grew up. But really, my first real addiction, David, was actually food. It was, kind of a Southern family, and genetically I come from obesity, background, and that was really my first addictive process, going to food to medicate stuff. Came up in it was a pretty tough upbringing, a mom who was pretty sick emotionally, dad who was emotionally speaking pretty distant, and so that's a pretty volatile combination. Then I found at 15, found alcohol and what it could do to tamp down all this anxiety I was having. So I kind of had the alcohol rolling. And then there was a, you know, there was the days of, you know, sneaking away with porn. And so by the time I'm 25 years old, I was married and then newly divorced due directly to the rage and the crazy emotional craziness that goes with those addictive processes, and in a trailer house in a little town in Oklahoma.
Wow.
And a couple of guys intervened on me, and I started my journey through AA and 12-step recovery, and I'm scared to death. And, you know, and it was a juggling act, those three main things to go to be medicated. You know, what I would think I had one dealt with is like the whack-a-mole game. And here it came. You know the routine.
Yeah, there's one. Oh, boom, there's the other one.
Yeah,
no,
like, hey, look, I'm losing weight. And pow, the other two go sky high. So, you know, that kind of thing. But through time and literally a day at a time, I know that's an old mantra for guys like us, but, you know, a day at a time, I began to be able to cobble together a recovery program. And a part of my love for the recovery process is what it did for me, starting in a really, really kind of crude level, like going into a room and going, hey, man, I don't know the 12 steps from Wild Honey, but I need help.
Yeah.
Somebody help me.
Yeah, yeah. And so you go through this, you begin going through this recovery process. Mm-hmm. And so what leads you into behavioral health as a profession?
Yeah, well, I was in the trucking business, not known for behavioral health.
That's a natural transition.
Out of the truck, off the dock, into the counselor's chair. I mean, everybody does that. My dad was in the trucking business on the management side of things. He was never on the driving side. And so I drove some, loaded freight, did the whole, you know, that kind of work, and then went into management with the company my dad worked for. And I always had this movement toward, I guess you would say, compassion. I was actually asked a question on another podcast one time, like how you're kind of known for, I guess, for lack of a better term, for shepherding people, I guess, would be more my stance on things. And I remember the story, and I don't remember ever thinking of it before, but when the person asked me the question, I remember hearing, more than seeing, hearing my siblings really being treated pretty roughly at home. And I remember this mantra over and over in my head. I would think to myself, hey, give the kid a break. Crazy as that may sound. But I think I took that and I began to see people that way. Like, man, people need a break. And that sounds pretty, you know, pretty low level stuff. But like, people need a break. People are hurting. And then I think my own story coming out of the trailer house situation, and, and it took me 10 years to finish college, and, you know, literally, and so I finished that degree. And as I began to be, you know, out of school and in recovery and clearing in my thinking and my health overall, that phrase, like, man, people have a rough time. People need a break.
Yeah.
And then there was anecdotal stuff going. People were kind of coming to me and saying, hey, let me talk for a minute. And I'm like, I'm a freight hound. I don't know why I got nothing to say to you. But it became something I began to look forward to. Like, I look forward to talking to people about my life and theirs.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of naturally morphed into. And at the time, I was a Southern Baptist boy, and Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas had a program that was – it was not biblical counseling. It was not pastoral care, which I think are great things. But I was a guy from the marketplace. I was from trucking. I wasn't from ministry. And so I wanted a degree that would allow me to have a state license. And so I went to that program for the theological underpinning and the ability to come out and have an LPC.
Okay.
And so
did it take you into church work for a while?
It did, very unexpectedly. I was, you know, I don't have a degree in, I have a master's in education from there and counseling, one in counseling. It was a dual degree program. I wasn't after two of them, but you notice neither of those are theology or homiletics or any of that kind of stuff. And so I never really imagined I would be a pastor, per se, vocationally. And the church we were attending wanted to start a ministry of pastoral care, and we were already in the church. And so they asked me to come on staff to do that, and then I love to teach, and so I was given opportunities to do that. And then our pastor left, and anytime a pastor leaves, it caused some upheaval, and I was kind of cast into the role of the senior position for a couple of years.
Wow!
And so I was kind of like, you know, the old story about, you know, how'd you learn to swim? Well, I got thrown in the 12-foot part and got out. That was kind of it for being a pastor for me. Like, okay, now you're a pastor.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's a baptism by fire.
Truly.
Pun intended, necessarily, yeah. But golly, yeah.
Yeah.
That can be hard enough for people that choose it, but to have it thrust upon you, so to speak, that's a
yes.
That's another.
I remember sitting before my first sermon thinking, this would have been a really good time to have had a preaching class. Which I didn't.
Well, maybe it's good. Maybe it's good that you didn't. Maybe you can just, you know, you don't know any better than to get up and speak from your heart.
Well, that's true. I literally rehearsed the sermon, and I thought, I got a good, solid 30-minute deal here. This is probably going to change the world. And so I actually got to preach it, and A, I had not written a conclusion because I got so freaked out, and B, it was 11 minutes.
So, okay. Yeah, well, that's when you have a long, if you're Baptist, you have a long invitation.
We did a lot of verses, yeah.
Yeah. <that's>, covers for that short sermon.
Yeah, pretty inauspicious start, actually.
Yeah. Wow, that's funny. Well, so you're now working in behavioral health, but you're mm-hmm. also still working with other ministries, right? Mm-hmm. Helping kind of consult or help form curriculum and things mm-hmm. like that. What kind of things are you doing?
Very good friend of mine and a friend of yours, I believe, mm-hmm. a guy named Jeff Schulte, right. and I wrote a Bible study.
Yeah.
It's kind of a companion to Chip's book, Voice of the Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, people would read that book and say, man, I know there's something about this writing that just strikes me as like theologically rich. But I mean, Chip didn't set out to write a theology book. You know,
right.
he wrote a book about feelings. And so mm-hmm. for years, people were saying, hey, I'm a Christian, I go to church, and I read this, and it seems so true mm-hmm. to it. And so Jeff and I, and Chip said, y'all write, I remember him saying to us, don't write a book for your seminary professors. Write a book for people to read that can connect feelings and the emotional world and relationship to Scripture and to their mm-hmm. Christianity. And
yeah.
so Jeff and I wrote that piece. We're now talking about, and it's kind of the talking, kind of the, I would say, storyboarding because it sounds cool, but we haven't done it. But we're talking at least about, you
yeah.
know, something that kind of takes a look at several people in Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And takes a look at their emotional life, not what they said for doctrine or mm-hmm. for teaching or mm-hmm. or prophecy, but like
yeah.
their lives. Like what can we glean from both the words of Scripture and what we know about them historically to say, hey, these are people, and they have feelings about things and
mm-hmm.
passions and appetites and desire. We want to write something about that.
Can you give me an example of like a one character you guys are looking at that you're kind of thinking about? In terms of what they might have been, how that feelings model might have been working
yeah.
in that?
There's a really famous one, you know, that everybody kind of picks on, I think. But, you know, this one of the big guys in Scripture, Elijah, he appears on the Mount of Transfiguration after his physical death. I mean, this is a big deal,
yeah.
you know, this guy.
Yeah.
In the famous story, 1 Kings 18, you know, he goes up on the mountain and just literally destroys these prophets,
mm-hmm.
these, you know, cultic prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, he's on a high, and he has done amazing things, you know, just his faith and his prophetic ministry. And, you know, the famous story, 1 Kings 19, man, that thing turns, and he becomes profoundly depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he's despairing of his own life, and he sees himself as all by himself. And if you did not know that was Elijah and you read that as a clinical write-up, you would mm-hmm. say, man, that guy is profoundly depressed.
Yeah.
Guy needs treatment.
Yeah.
Because he's suicidal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, and so here's this real live human, a guy who years later, chronologically speaking, is going to be up on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus and Moses
mm-hmm.
and the three disciples. Like, this is a big guy, and this very human man is completely depleted physically, mentally, emotionally, and when he gets information that someone is very angry with him, Jezebel, somebody
mm-hmm.
who means business,
mm-hmm.
this very human man craters, he implodes, and you know, you're, mm-hmm. you know, that he's been so angry, meaning in a biblical manner, like he's been angry for something, he's been angry at what he saw in front of him,
mm-hmm.
he's taken action on it up on the mountain. And then all of a sudden, he hears of Jezebel being angry with him, and the implosion is a thing called depression,
mm-hmm.
anger not expressed.
Yeah,
he's depleted. He turns and implodes, and he can't see anything in his life other than he depresses
mm-hmm.
all this passion that he's had up on that mountain. And so God feeds him and ministers to him and speaks to him. and Elijah. What's amazing, what can often get missed in that story, is at the end of that story, that narrative, God directs Elijah to go hook up with a guy named Elisha. Mm-hmm. He sends him to another human being mm-hmm. to do ministry with him.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's not because God's insufficient or not enough. That's mm-hmm. such a model, I think, to say, hey, when we get depleted and we are devoid of anger for living and anger for the passion for life, mm-hmm. that's called depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to a guy named Elijah.
Yeah.
And how did he get out of that? Well, he began to take care of himself holistically, took care of his body.
Yeah.
God fed him. He rested. And then when he got back up, God directed him to go get with another human being to do what he's made to do.
Mm. Yeah.
So as an example, that's one that stands out to me.
And we use the connection model today. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what we constantly are working with people as part of addiction recovery. You know, mm-hmm. it's a connection, lack of connection,
yes.
Disorder, all of that. And we see all kinds of stuff when people connect. We know the front part of the brain responds and all this kind of stuff. And it's interesting, we don't think about that when we look at maybe those of us that came up through the Bible stories, yes. so to speak, Sunday school. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, we were given the timeline and the facts and the historic kind of outline, but yes. not the personal. I mean, the personality, the I don't know, maybe the analysis of mm-hmm. that person and that they were like us. You know, they were us, and we are them, really.
Yes. It's inadvertently, I think, David, we've learned a lot about what they did, about
mm-hmm.
doing,
mm-hmm.
and we've been told, think like them
mm-hmm.
a lot. And
mm-hmm.
I don't believe this is intentional, but that whole territory of emotion and feeling and desire has been, in some not all the time, but mm-hmm. in some ways, left behind.
Right.
Like be like Elijah, trust God for everything. Be like Elijah, go do great things.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, get yourself together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we lose the fact of what this man went through, what we know he went through, his terror, and his depressing of his anger, and what God did to minister to him, including bringing into his life another man.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like to me, if we miss the humanity in the stories,
mm-hmm.
The Bible's really just a comic book. In the sense that, mm-hmm. You know, you've got these one-dimensional cut-out characters.
Yes.
You know,
right.
That really don't have a lot of depth. They're, you know they're going to win, or you know they're not, or you know,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it doesn't seem like it seems like we lose that human piece that we would be able to relate to ourselves.
Uh-huh.
Why do you think Christians are so afraid of their feelings? And I know that sounds like an overgeneralization, and it's kind of a broad brush question, but the people I see, and I'm sure a lot of the people that you see, many times if they come from certain backgrounds, they are scared to death of their feelings.
Yes.
Why do you think that occurs?
You know, I think that one of the base answers is, you know, this thing we call toxic shame. And, you know, we talk a lot about that in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And John Bradshaw wrote the, you know, kind of the benchmark book mm-hmm. around all that and how it works. And, you know, toxic shame is that thing that says, if you show any of your humanness, you better straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think we have inadvertently in the church communicated that feelings equal weakness and lack of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lack of self-control, a lack of right thinking, a lack of true doctrine, a lack of belief in the power of God. And so I think a lot of Christians will, believe that if I'm going to truly follow Christ, I'm really going to do this, I dare not ever have any fear of anything because God is sufficient. And I dare not ever feel lonely because God is sufficient. I dare not ever be angry because God's got this. And
mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean those things are inaccurate. It just means that we are human. And the fact that God is sufficient and he does have this in my humanity, I have a language in me of cry out that says, but I can't do all that. I'm not sufficient in and of myself and I need you.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, if you, David, even you pick up a copy of the Bible, a physical copy of it, you know, we got two chapters in the beginning of it that describe a world in which everything's fantastic and we don't have any sadness and we don't have loneliness. And Adam was lonely and God said, okay, you need a person. Now you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then we've got a couple of chapters at the end where it's that way again. And all in between, we've got this horrific story going on that's far beyond opinion and far beyond thought and far beyond preference. It is a very emotion-driven world we live in.
Right.
But we miss that, I think, because it's really scary for people to have liberty to be afraid out loud, and to talk about how lonely they are and to be angry about something, like having to, hey, straighten up and make sure you look like you've got it all handled because of the sufficiency of God. And again, that doesn't take away from God's sufficiency. It's like, but I'm not him. I'm a real dependent creature. I've got these feelings to describe my life between Genesis 2 and Revelation 21.
Yeah. And what about when we take that to the level of like a staff member, like you were and I was for a long time of a church? And when we go through some of these things, you know, it's bad for business.
Yeah, it's not a good advertisement.
It's not like, you know, we're going to put that in on on the webpage.
Here's our crying music guy. What do you think?
With a shot glass, by the way.
Yeah, well, I know that
Keep that out. Photoshop that out, by the way. You don't need that flask that's up there on the piano. You don't need that. No, I never took a flask to church. I do pride myself in that.
Good job, David.
Yeah, way to go.
Atta boy.
I am high. That's not to say I didn't have moments before or after, but you know, we didn't leave things at home. But yeah, you know what? We get into staff members, and we've convinced ourselves that somehow we're getting paid to be something way beyond what we are capable of, in my opinion.
Oh, yes. It's such a, what do you call it, contradiction or oxymoron to be in ministry. And part of the work is to carry things with other people and sometimes carry things for them. Like in Galatians, you know, when we need help bearing our burdens, carrying the boulders, and yet we have our own backpacks that we're in charge of, so to speak, like hands and heart, actually. But yeah, there's somehow or another, there's this narrative that says if you are in ministry, if you're a staff member, then here's what you do. You carry these things with other people and sometimes for other people, but don't you dare have a human experience of anger or fear or loneliness or sadness or hurt around all of this. You must armor yourself up, the very thing Jesus was not. Covered with armor. Armor yourself up and carry all this stuff and never let them see you sweat.
Right. And I mean, don't you think that in some respect that it's actually good for people to see you sweat?
For sure.
I mean, to be able to say, I probably need a minute here and here's why.
Yes.
'Cause I've taken on more than I need to, and I'm paying for it, and that's on me.
Yes.
But whatever, you know, the scenario is. But I would imagine that frees people more than it intimidates them.
Oh, I've seen it over and over and over. Now, you know, a lot of it had to do with trucking, as we call it. You know, when I was a pastor, like people would say, Phil, thank you so much for talking about walking a freight dock at 2 a.m. in Amarillo, Texas in a snowstorm. And you hated it, and it was so hard, you were so lonely, and thank you for talking about driving a truck at 20 years old, not knowing what you were doing, lonely, and all the medicating things that you did, and, you know, like, that I've, over and over, and that's not because I'm some great pastor, it's like, no, that's way more about, I didn't have homiletics, I didn't know you weren't supposed to say stuff like that, and, you know, and, but it does say, there's those very powerful words, and I think, you know, like I said, when in doubt, quote, attribute a quote to C.S. Lewis, but I think it actually was him that said, you know, the two most beautiful words in the English language are me too.
Yeah.
And it's like when people can experience a spiritual leader saying, oh, yeah, me too. There's something about that, you know, over that cup of coffee or sitting in that office or wherever, it's like, okay, I'm sitting with a human. And that doesn't mean we don't have, as pastors or leaders, pastor or not, that we don't have responsibility to, when we're in a helping relationship with someone, of course, I need to deal with my stuff and not lay it on them. Mm-hmm. My Me Too doesn't need to turn into them helping me necessarily. Mm-hmm. But if I do have a Me Too and I'm helping someone, I got to have people in my life mm-hmm. that I'm in that other chair with.
Yeah.
And pastors are, as we know, some of the most isolated people in the world because they have these shoulds in them that say, I shouldn't be dealing with this. I dare not let anybody know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I better hide this over here, which, again, part of that is helping people, not bringing your stuff to them. Mm-hmm. But if there's no outlet for the pastor, for the minister, for the leader, for the mm-hmm. helper to be in the other chair, that's where it gets really, really sick.
Yeah.
And people start getting shamed for having feelings about living in a world that Scripture says we're not made for in this condition.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you and I see a lot of people that come in from backgrounds, evangelical backgrounds, church backgrounds mm-hmm. of one type or another, and addiction is a reality.
Uh-huh.
It's not this thing that simply is a resort, in my opinion, a moral failure kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This is a biological, physiological, emotional, psychological, name your logical, pick
yes.
your logical,
yes.
And pin it on it. And it is what it is. Mm-hmm. And yet, they've come in from these places where maybe that's not been understood
yeah.
real well, you know,
yeah.
by the community. Do you see a lot of people that are experiencing a lot of spiritual abuse?
Mm-hmm. I do, and that is a harsh yet I believe accurate phrase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, spiritual abuse. The word abuse is so like hard, and I think mm-hmm. it's true. It's a mistreatment. Yes, and you know, in human nature and the addictive process itself can take what they hear and turn it into something through their toxic shame and all that maybe was never said, but the message inside of it was, hey, don't be human, and if you struggle with this, you need to get yourself right.
Mm-hmm.
Get yourself right.
Mm-hmm.
Straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have begun a ministry at our church in Murfreesboro called Regeneration. It's a recovery ministry, and every single Tuesday night, without fail, someone will say, I am so glad I can sit in my church building and speak this way,
mm-hmm.
talk about this stuff, because I don't know what would happen to me, abuse, if you mm-hmm. will. I don't know what happened to me if I said this kind of thing out loud.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I do when I get home at night to make myself okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I've got going on as a side hustle that no one knows about, a secret life I've got going on outside
right.
of here no one knows about. But I come in this room and I can say that.
Yeah. And then how can we help the church understand how to love people
yeah.
who find themselves in those situations?
Yeah. This is not a plug for any particular thing. I'm telling you, if people would simply sit down, goofy as this may sound, with that Bible study and that book, Voice of the Heart,
mm-hmm.
and say, I'm going to talk through these chapters, and I don't say that for advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the book and the Bible study if you want. Sit down across from somebody and say, I want to talk to you about 8 words inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
I am angry, I am sad, I am lonely, I am hurt, I am guilty, I am glad, I am sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those, I may have just been 7, but, you know, if we in the church, quote unquote, could begin the process of just sitting across from people and not shaming people for having feelings about their life and what they're doing to medicate those feelings,
mm-hmm.
I think we'd see a heck of a change.
Yeah.
I actually went when I was intervened on, it's 1985, I moved from this little town in Oklahoma out to Texas, and I made a beeline for the biggest church I could find in town. I wanted to know, did they have something that was like AA
mm-hmm.
for me to go to? And they didn't, and that's not an aspersion on that church or any other,
mm-hmm.
but maybe a little late in the game to
mm-hmm.
finally start addressing these things, but... I think if the church would address addiction,
mm-hmm.
straight up addiction, and all that addiction means, you know, the pathological relationship with an ego defense mechanism that mm-hmm. continues despite negative consequences, you know?
Yeah.
How's that for clinical?
Yeah, there you go.
but, you know, people would address, hey, folks, what are you doing that's sick, that's dysfunctional, that's unhealthy? What are you doing to deal with your internal world?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to deal with how angry you are, how traumatized you are, these memories that you have of where you come from? What are you doing to address your emotional responses to that? Because walk through people's story. You've done it for years. I've done it for years. Walking through people's stories, David, as you know, it's like that. It is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And if we relegate people walking through their stories to just what they're thinking about it
mm-hmm.
and just what they need to do doctrinally about it, we are missing the part of the story that lodges inside of them that has to be medicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will begin to access that part that's unaddressed, the feelings and emotional responses of those memories of where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
I think would be an amazing opening mm-hmm. Of that. I had a professor in school. I love him. He died in his 90s fairly recently. He used to say, hey, listen to me. Don't ever lead a drunk man to Jesus. He doesn't mean it, but it sure is good for your ego. What he meant was like, hey, people are suffering and sick, and we rush to create a solution
yeah.
that is spiritual, which, of course, I want people to accept Christ, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But so often we rush to make sure I can be okay because I've told them the truth of the gospel before I have sat down and talked to them about what those tears are for.
Mm-hmm.
What are you remembering in that story? And what in the world is that alcohol or sex or gambling or food or work or spending or whatever it is? What in the world, what are the tears that that stuff is addressing?
Yeah.
I think it would be an amazing transformation of discipleship,
mm-hmm.
Among other things, if we could, as the body, and like you said earlier, not the generalization, but as the body in general, would, quote unquote, sit down together and say, we got to start talking about the internal world of human beings, because the trying and the doing is falling really short.
Yeah.
And maybe the gospel is a whole lot about these human beings in the human struggle
mm-hmm.
to move beyond the medication they've been using to have a real, rich, emotional, relational, attached life that is created through walking through that story.
Yeah.
Right here. I think it'd be an amazing transformation.
Yeah, I think that's true, and so how do we approach people whose faith systems might differ from the things that we've experienced,
mm-hmm.
or they don't particularly identify with a particular faith system?
Yeah.
It seems like, for instance, like your feelings model still applies.
Uh huh.
You
yes.
know that. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah.
I'm throwing you the curveball. That's,
hey, thanks
that's
for the
my
small
job.
Question, David. Next, we'll split the atom, folks. Stay tuned.
That's right. And for my next trip.
Wow. Okay. We went from, now you don't just do 90 days anymore, do you? We went from that to this. Wow.
Yeah, okay. Like, what are you going to do with this guy?
David Hampton's reputation's earned, folks. That actually is a great question, and you nail the answer. Like, there is a universal language,
right?
And it is called feelings. I read about a research project they did, and they audio recorded babies from all across the world.
Oh, wow.
And guess what they found? Like, okay, they sound the same, and it's coming from the same place, and there's all kinds
mm-hmm.
of science, all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but bottom line is, hey, you know what? We're born with a language called cry out.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
And when you have children, oh, you're a dad, like, you don't have to go to a seminar to teach these children how to let you know they're in need.
Yeah.
Or they're angry.
Yeah.
Or they're lonely. Like, kids will say it. And so children are born with a universal language.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so if we were to just say, hey, I know the faith practice is different,
mm-hmm.
but let's talk about this human right here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be a human with you.
Mm-hmm.
Please be one with me.
Yeah.
Tell me your story about where you're angry and sad and hurt and wounded and injured and traumatized and
mm-hmm.
mad and all
yeah.
that other stuff. And who knows what God does with conversations like that. That's
mm-hmm.
up to Him. And if I say that my theology is I believe in the I believe in the sovereignty and the providence of God, that He mm-hmm. holds time in His hands, mm-hmm. then I can have a conversation with someone who doesn't believe like I do and trust God with that conversation and talk human to human.
Yeah.
It's a place to start.
Yeah, that's a great answer to a tricky question. Sorry about that. But I love that you brought up the baby thing, because I was just with my 9-month-old grandson this weekend. My daughter and son-in-law had to show houses a couple of days on Saturday and Sunday. They're in real estate. And so They asked if I could come over just 2 or 3 hours, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, I love Patrick. I've been with Patrick off and on since the day he was born, mm-hmm. you know, 2 or 3 hours, how tough can that be, really? You know, I mean, I know it's tough, but it's not like tough, right?
Sure.
So I get there, and of course, he's crawling a lot, but he's also standing, and he's taken a step or two, you know, but he's learned he can pull himself up on the couch mm-hmm. and stand and maneuver himself across the couch by holding on to get to where he wants to be, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So all this is to say, I get there, and this kid moves like a sand crab. He's fast. He's in from this thing to that thing. I've got every toy that known to man spread out in the living room floor. I've got all the baby barriers all around. So we're in this kind of cattle pen that we've made out of, you know, these brightly colored gates. And he's got all these toys, and he's like, scurry, scurry, scurry. Because what he really wants to do is not play with anything on the floor. He wants to climb the bookcase, you know, because he's learned he can pull up on it. And then he's learned he can put his foot on a book, and then he can start up, and then he's doing, you know. And what he really wants to get to is the DVR box.
Of course.
Because it glows and makes, you know. Now, they've got a huge TV that when they play the nature videos, it looks like an aquarium. They've got, you know, all this stuff going on. And Patrick knows that he wants none of that. He wants to climb the bookcase.
Yes.
And so for about 2.5 hours, we played Chase Me to the Bookcase. And, no, you can't climb the bookcase. Let's come over here. Let's play with this. Here's your little toy thing, you know. And it's so funny because it is such a study in us.
Yes.
You know, and so I love that. I love that you brought that up, that analogy, because I told my daughter, I said, we were in constant motion for 3 hours.
Uh-huh.
And she goes, okay.
Yeah, hey, Dad, really? You know, I call that Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and in her case, not to get off into all their business, but PJ, her husband, was in Poland for 8 months. He's in the military.
Boy, wow.
And so she had Patrick, and PJ was in Poland. We FaceTimed him. And the first 8 months of Patrick's life was just Lauren. You know, I mean, she had help coming in a little bit here and there, but you know, it was day and night.
Wow.
So, you know, she learned a lot about human nature, her own and her babies and mine and everybody's.
And isn't it crazy how we learn, you know, an adult would want to climb the bookcase, mm-hmm. but pretend to enjoy the truck.
Exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Not him.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, I'm 9 months old. I got nothing to lose here. I'm a human. I really want to do that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, hey, God made us that way. I know sin and all that. We're egocentric human beings. But, like, I love the story. Brendan Manning tells a very similar story that he was mentoring this young man, and he invited the young man and his wife and the little boy over to eat dinner. And his wife was made chocolate chip cookies for the – and I'm kind of butcher this story. But the bottom line is the man and wife said, oh, Dr. Manning, thank you for having us in your home. It's so beautiful. Thank you so much. And Brendan Manning got on one knee and said, hey, you must be Johnny. And Johnny said, yeah, I sure am. Where are the cookies? I was like, little humans will say, then, you know, that's not okay. It's not socially appropriate. But the raw humanness in children gets kind of, and I know we have to be adults and look at etiquette and those kinds of things, but the core that we live from, children do so beautiful. Patrick was doing that so beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, his humanness. And we lose that in the church by cleaning everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get dirty again? Those words that describe our internal experience.
Yeah, yeah. Right, and don't you just wish sometimes that you could just lay in the floor and kind of just scream and know that there are people around you that love you enough to just say, don't mind him. We got it.
He's
just
having a moment.
Oh,
yes. You know, I really do.
Because I really, there are those times, you know, I watch him, I was like, you know, that would not be that would be kind of be a luxury.
Yes.
You know, to have.
My grandmother called it having a spell. Phillip's having a spell.
Yeah, my friend from Alabama calls it a come apart.
But it's so human, though. Like, you know, and I understand you can't have a spell and a come apart every second of the day. We got jobs and stuff, right? But there is that human condition called I have a cry out in me. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, and we create these ways that are socially acceptable, and some of them aren't. And that's where, as Bruce Willis said in the movie The Kid, that's where it gets dicey, is where the mechanisms to deal with all these feelings we're having become so unhealthy and destructive. And David, you know this working in the field. It leads to death.
Yeah.
People die from addiction.
Yeah, literally.
And so, you know, people die from codependency addiction. People die from seeking the approval of someone so much that they will die in the process of trying to get approval.
Yeah.
It's not just chemical.
Yeah.
And so what if, in the church in particular, what if we began to sit down with one another and say, I understand there's doctrine. I totally get that God is sufficient. Mm-hmm. And in these moments, let's let that assumption hover over us. And now let's get to it, heart to heart.
Yeah.
Talk about all the woundedness and the trauma and all those other things. And I said it a while ago, I really believe it would be transforming if we had permission to be Patrick in an adult manner.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too. I think that's the most honest we can be, you know? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like at times the church moralizes this problem in a way that, because we put everything into a sin context, whatever that means to different people, that therefore, if I can't change this behavior, I've got to mask it.
Yes,
you know.
And what's so, I think the answer is profoundly yes. And what is so crazy about that is what was the biggest part of Jesus's anger and frustration around humans. Is when he, in my imagination at least, he's yelling. I don't know that he was, but he's yelling, you wash the outside of the cup, and inside it's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. You got it reversed, people.
Yeah.
Deal with the inside world, and you don't have to clean the outside of the cup.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so I think the answer is yes, so sadly yes, that there's a... I got to throw out my big phrase of the day because I read stuff and want people to know I know stuff.
You've been dying to use it?
Oh, yeah. Here goes, David. Get ready, man. Buckle up. Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yo, I'm going to tell you. Okay. Do you have that trademarked? Like,
well,
if I use that, do you get money? Or
someone else wrote it, and I'm so jealous. But
say it one more time for us.
I'm so glad you asked that. Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Yeah.
All right. Unpack it
a little bit. Yeah. I so want credit for that.
Oh, man.
David, I call it MTD. I don't know if anybody else does. But here's what it is. It's this, it was a research study of adolescents.
Okay.
And what they believed about God, what they believed about following Christ, I think specifically. And here's what basically it amounted to this. If I'm a good moral person, and I want good for other people.
Right.
And I practice healthy skills with people, then God is kind of around to kind of be my butler and my therapist. Like he's not someone I worship or pray to or cry out in my desperation. So I've worked really hard. Now, this isn't every single individual. I work really hard to clean up the outside, as you said, to be moral, to do moral, act moral, and to make sure what I say to people is therapeutic. And meanwhile, God's kind of off doing other stuff until I need him. Which, you know, people say recovery units are spiritual programs. Like part of that means is I am kind of in some level of a constant cry out.
Yeah.
And so it's so easy to say, wait a minute, if I just work hard on doing and being good morally and be kind of, you know, say healthy stuff to people, I kind of got this thing made.
Yeah.
And again, inadvertently, not every church and not every pastor, maybe not even the majority, I don't know, but I know there is a vein that runs through, certainly a later generation that runs through that says, no, the issue is not clawing at the dirt because I'm so hurt and so scared and so angry and so lonely. No. It's be nice and say healthy things and call on God if you need him. which is the antithesis of the scriptures, then certainly the antithesis of recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, man, I'm desperate about 27 hours a day.
Yeah.
I'm always kind of on the verge of a come apart or a spell.
Yeah.
On some level about something.
Yeah.
You know, and so that big fancy, it was a research project they did on what are the attitudes of people around their Christianity. Mm-hmm. And what came out was two writers coined this phrase. There's this belief, if I clean up the outside morally, mm-hmm. If I talk good, mm-hmm. you know, about things, then I can always call on God if I ever need him.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of has become a prevailing attitude. And so once again, I think those conversations between people that get down to the nitty gritty, what's inside the cup, pour out the inside of the cup on this table between us sitting here at Starbucks and let's talk about what's really going on.
Yeah.
Whether it's moral or not, or whether it's therapeutic or not, or mm-hmm. whether it's whatever or not, let's mm-hmm. assume that where you are with God is where you are with God, and he is who he is regardless of where we are with him. Now let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Let's get down in this.
Yeah. Let what is true be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thank you for being here today.
So good to see you again,
David. It is so good to have you with us. How can people get a hold of you and some of these programs that you're working with?
Yeah, we have a direct number. The Professionals Program at Journey Peer has a direct number, mm-hmm. Local, 615-837-2282.
Okay.
Or my first initial P and last name HERNDON at journeypeer.com.
Okay.
Get you to us.
Yeah.
And man, we'd love to, if you need help or some direction, love to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, we'd love to connect people with you guys, and all the best, too, on this this feelings approach to the characters in Scripture. That sounds like a pretty fascinating
thank you.
Endeavor.
Fun
I can't
so
wait
far.
Till you get to David, and I'll be all in.
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah, David. He is quite – he could probably be the whole thing.
Yeah, that's I don't know. I've related to him for some reason. Uh-huh. I don't know why, really. But
yeah, it's called Psalms. Holy cow. What a life.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, man. Well, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for stopping by. And I know that Nate hates that he was not here to be with you today. So we will maybe next time. So
right on. Thanks, David.
All right. Well, we will be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and that was so much fun. That conversation with Phil Herndon was a really refreshing permission to just let what is real be real in our lives. I hope that as listeners, you guys are getting the message here that we are a safe place. We want you to appreciate the opportunity to connect with us, contact us, share your stories with us. We love hearing your stories. We love hearing from you. What impacts you? What has meant a lot to you? And things that you're going through in your own life. And hopefully, in turn, you are able to help create safe spaces in your own world, in your own places, in your own communities, in your own families, that you become a safe person for others as you grow in your own recovery. So for now, I'm David Hampton, and I want to thank you so much for being a faithful follower. Share the podcast with people that you think would benefit from it, and we will see you again next time here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelly, music by Rex Schnelly, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.